This is Alan Farley. It's a delight to have a chance to meet you after listening to you on my music all these years.
Thank you.
I know the program is no longer being produced, but it's still very popular around the world. And I wonder if you could just tell us how you came to be on the program. How did it all begin?
Well, it began, oddly enough, it was originally going to be a project for overseas transmissions rather than domestic. And the person who got the job to produce it was Tony Schran, who was the producer of one of the most famous soap operas of all time in this country, about the countryside, called The Archers. And he had before that been producer of a program called Dick Barton, which was one of these great car chases, and you're left hanging on the edge of a cliff every day. But this for Tony was something quite different, and he sent for me and said, "I want you to be in a program. It's only going to be a pilot scheme. We don't know whether it has any future at all." But he said the basic idea is two comics, very distinguished comic writers and script writers, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, and two musical experts, yourself and David Franklin. David Franklin, who died back in the 70s, was the first one in the team and was replaced by John Amos, of course. And I went pale. I said, "I'm not a musical expert." I said, studied law and I'm a sort of self-made opera singer, as you might say, but huge gaps exist in my musical knowledge. And he said, "Well, never mind. I think it will work out." And he said, "The chairman is Steve Race, who was a name to conjure with long before my music appeared on the scene." And so the first recording was in London, and I really was pretty scared, because I thought I'm going to be shown up for not having the requisite musical knowledge for a quiz very, very quickly. And then the first piece of music I had to identify, I remember, was a bridge passage from Mendelssohn's overture, The Hebrides. And I thought, I've got one right. And so that cheered me up. And then a little bit later, Steve asked Dennis, he said, "Dennis, can you translate into English La Donna e Mobile?" And quick as a flash, Dennis said, "My bird's got a motorbike." And I thought, well, if it's going to be like that, then I really haven't anything to worry about. And I realized that one simply had to, if one didn't know the answer, one had at least to be amusingly ignorant. That was the important thing. And the pilot was regarded as satisfactory, and so we had the domestic BBC knocking on our door wanting to take the program. And I think one of the reasons why it has been continued to be heard for such a long time is that, and it was a very far-sighted bit of policy, that because it was going out to the external services, which was all over the world, literally, we had a producer, Douglas Hesp, who was there simply to listen from the point of view, as he said, of somebody up a coconut tree listening on a tranny, and would they understand it, which meant that all topical political allusions did not appear. You'll find that there's nothing in those programs. I mean, there might be, Margaret Thatcher might be mentioned a couple of times in 2 or 3 years, but it wasn't at all a program with people making gags about the present situation. And I think that has contributed to its longevity as a program. And it was such an enjoyable program to do. We all got on fine. One of the things that I think contributed to its success was that when we weren't recording, we hardly ever met. We weren't in and out of one another's houses, so that when we did meet to do the show, we were pleased to see one another. And I mean, we probably did, I think it was 518 altogether, and Steve and I were the only two who never missed one. We did them all. I mean, I was taken from a hospital bed once in a taxi to do it and straight back to hospital.
Really?
I wasn't very ill, but I was in for investigation at the time. That was in the early 80s. And there was just a sort of feeling of oh, good, it's round to the time when we go down. And I used often to say, driving down there, how wonderful, I'm going to be paid, not a lot, for my colleagues to make me roar with laughter. And it took me quite some time to have the confidence to make jokes with these two masters of the art sitting one opposite me and one beside me. And then the reaction when I came out with one or two things was interesting, because at first they wouldn't laugh, but they'd give me an approving nod as if to say, good on you. And the whole thing, of course, had other effects for us all, I think, insofar as far as I was concerned. It led to me being able to go out into all the music clubs and do my one-man show, and people wanted to see who it was who sang the song at the end of my music. No, a thoroughly happy experience that went on for upwards of 26 or 27 years.
Well, talk a little bit about the final songs, the party pieces, as they were called.
Oh, yes. Well, the great thing about this program was the spontaneity of it, and it wasn't really entirely spontaneous that the very first programs, when in the days when Ted Mason, Edward J. Mason, set the questions, I wasn't given any notice, and he'd say, he would tell me in the pub before the program, perhaps, one of your songs tonight is Cushy Butterfield. I said, that's a Geordie song. That's Owen Branigan. That's not Ian Wallace. And he goes, well, do the best you can. You see, well, of course, that very soon they had to change that. Members of the public wrote in and said, give him songs he knows. And so the songs would be chosen. Steve and I would have a session before, weeks before, maybe. And he would say, well, I'll give you a two-bar introduction to this. And what key do you want it in? And how many verses are there? And I would never hear the accompaniment that he was going to play until the actual recording. So that, to that degree, it was spontaneous. And the songs, people used to write in and say, why don't you sing such and such? Why don't you sing? And I'd say, that I would love to sing, but you cannot cut it to 1 minute 30 seconds, which was the maximum. And I used to love singing standards. At first, I was kept more onto the funnies, and then finally it was decided that the funny song should be for Frank and Dennis, and that I would instead sing, you know, the very thought of you, and I forget to do the little ordinary things that everyone ought to do. And I loved singing these. Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, all of those sorts of songs, plus folk songs and pretty well any type of song you like to think of that you could do in 1 minute, a version of it in 1 minute 30 seconds.
One of the things I do each week is a program that runs between my word and my music, which I call the Noel Coward Entr'acte. And I try to find a Noel Coward song that has some connection with something mentioned in my music.
Oh, yes.
Now, sometimes it's a real stretch, and sometimes I just throw up my hands and play a Coward song that I choose.
Yes.
But do you have any Coward recollections?
I have one very precious recollection, and it's the only one. It was in about 1960, and I was doing a show at the Criterion Theatre called Four to the Bar, and there were only four of us in it. There was a couple of very talented cabaret people, but also one of them was a scriptwriter, Brian Blackburn, and Peter Reeves was a good actor as well. And they did all sorts of old songs with topical words put to them. It was very fashionable at that time. And Rose Hill, the soprano, she came in the second half of the show. But it was really, I had to carry it and do the Anchorman stuff, as well as singing a wide variety of stuff. And one night I was peering out through the gauze in the prompt corner before going on, and to my amazement saw there was Noel Coward, and I think it was Joyce Carey, the actress, was with him. And I went to the boys, because I did the first 20 minutes on my own, and I went to the boys and said, Coward is out there. Now, don't be cast down if he's not there for the second half, because he often sees half of one show, I'm told, and then goes on to something else. But he was there for the second half. And after the show was over, tap on my dressing room door, and to my amazement, there he was. And he came in, and he started marking, because they were all sort of single items in the show, which I linked together. He sort of went down marking them like an exam, and they were all getting pretty good marks, I must say. And after I'd about 2 minutes only, I said, you seem to have liked the show. Could I invite my cast of thousands to hear what you have to say? Of course, dear boy. And I opened the door and they fell in, including Tony Bowles, our pianist, and John Jobson, the double bass player. And we were all in the room, and he went through this whole show, which he'd liked very much. And he'd only one criticism. I had wore a dinner jacket and had black sort of silk socks, but our producer was paranoic that I would show a bit of bare calf, and had these very, very long silks, practically like stockings. And he said, only one wardrobe thing. He said, I was fascinated by your stockings. You should have had a credit in the programme. Mr. Wallace's black socks by Kaiser Bondar, who were great stocking makers. But then he said the words that have been graven on my memory ever since, and which gave me so much confidence and to go on and do a one-man show, which I did for many, many years. He said, you have a great command over your audience. Mind you, anybody who has got the hardihood to start a play in the West End of London not till 8:40 and have the rag go up on them, and you find him with a brandy bulb in one hand and a cigar in the other, has bloody well got to have command of their audience. And to me, this was, you know, it made a tremendous boost to my confidence, that, as you can imagine.
What was the one-man show?
Well, the one-man show, I used to simply call it An Evening with Ian Wallace, and it was... it was the suggestion of Charles Ross, who produced Four to the Bar, that I should do this. And I tried to link together all the different things that I'd done, the opera, acting, the funny songs, Flanders and Swan. And it was an evening of anecdotes, all of them about funny things that had happened to me. It wasn't, and then I went and was... amid tumultuous applause. You know, it wasn't like that a bit. It was, and then you know, you fell flat on your face or whatever it was. And by the end, I had three different editions of it for people who were plucky enough to ask me back. And I had various people who played for me, a marvellous man who had been a recital critic at the Wigmore Hall called David Money. And he... from certain points of view, was the best, because he laughed at the jokes as if he'd never heard them every night. He was a marvellous backcloth, as you might say. And we had a great rapport. So I did that for 20 years. I only stopped it because the medic said that if I went on, it would kill me, because it was very strenuous. I mean, singing Big Aria from Rossini's Cenerentola to finish the first half, having begun it with a big Si Trai Ceppi of Handel, and then art songs and all the stories and everything. And I was on there for 2 hours altogether, an hour and then 10-minute interval, and then nearly another hour, getting lighter and lighter and lighter all the way.
Well, we're talking with Ian Wallace here in Highgate, in his home, and I'd like to go back a little further now and find out about this checkered career that you say started as a lawyer.
I read law before the war at Cambridge University to please my father. In those days, you had to do that because that was the sole source of support, and he had started as an office boy in a linoleum works in Scotland at the age of 14 at half a crown a week, and worked himself up to be London managing director, a member of parliament and a knighthood, and a marvellous man my father was. And he had felt that I ought to read law and then either have a legal career, because he knew he'd met people in the House of Commons from the legal profession, and it looked pretty lucrative from the outside. And if it wasn't going to be that, then it would be a springboard to leap into the political arena. Well, it didn't work out that way. I was saved from that legal career by the war and tuberculosis of the spine, as I lay for 20 months on my back and 50-50 chance of recovery. And I always decided if that even money bet came down my side, I must give my first love, the theatre, a chance, because I'd been on for any amateur theatricals all through school and Cambridge and even in the army. And so I started my career as an actor and in Scotland. And I started quite the wrong way round, because terrific shortage of people at this time. This was 1944. The war was still on. I'd been invalided out. And I was in a play in a small, what you would call, if it had been New York, off-Broadway theatre. A play by Ashley Dukes was the playwright. It was called The Man with the Loge of Mischief, and I played a Regency buck. And I was absolutely huge in those. I'd laid on my back and they poured the food in, because there were no drugs then to cure. I missed them by about 5 years. And a great spinal jacket with leather strips up the back. So I was huge. And they sent up from London a costume for me. And it had the name Robert Morley in the collar, and it was much too small. So you can imagine how big I was at that time. An odd coincidence that I would co-star with Robert Morley in a musical at Drury Lane not all that long after that, 1956. And this, what we're talking about is 1944. And so I started as an actor, but then came back to London. This was in Glasgow, the play. And I was auditioned for a play called The Glass, a musical Christmas show called The Glass Slipper, which was a version of Cinderella, produced by the famous film star Robert Donat, with music by Clifton Parker. And I played a number of small parts, as a result of which I was asked to audition for the Royal Opera House. I mean, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it? And I did many auditions. When I say many, three or four, they kept asking me back. And Then finally they said, well, we're rapidly coming to the conclusion we can use you, and offered me the part of Papageno in The Magic Flute. But it wasn't going to take place for quite some time. And meanwhile, somebody had persuaded me to audition for a new company, an opera company that was starting up, called the New London Opera Company at London's Cambridge Theatre in Seven Dials. And to make a long story short, they took me on for the part of Schaunard in La Bohème. Well, when they offered me the part of Schaunard, I had to go back to the Royal Opera House and say, what am I to do? And they said, oh, that's a good idea. Give you some experience. You haven't any experience of the operatic stage. And that company won't last more than a couple of months. And then you come to us. And I had no contract signed or anything like that. So I set off. And the company, instead of lasting 2 months, lasted 2 years. And provided me with a form of postgraduate, as you might say, training. I mean, I'd only had a few singing lessons. I hadn't seen the inside of a music college or a music college or an academy of dramatic art or anything like that. And I sang Schaunard in La Bohème, the Sacristan in Tosca, Dr. Bartolo in Barbieri di Siviglia, Mazzetto in Don Giovanni. That was just about it, I think. And I had the advantage of working with Alberto Iredi, the Italian conductor, Dino Borgioli, who was the vocal director, and also producer of some of the operas that we did. And it took London by storm. The impresario was a Russian, Jay Pomeroy, who was a very sharp businessman, and he financed it most lavishly, and it was really all a setting for his mistress, because that was another of the parts I did in her. Her debut was in Rigoletto as Gilda, and she was not a great soprano, but she was very beautiful, and the whole thing revolved round her in a sense. And I was being paid a quite good salary for being taught my business, because people like Mariano Stabile, the baritone who played Scarpia in Tosca, he went for the Italian pronunciation of the Brits in the cast, and saw that we pronounced their beautiful language. They didn't like, I mean, we like it when artists come here, like going way back, Maurice Chevalier, you know, when I was in my infancy, I formed a little habit, you know, we like that over here, but if Italians don't like the equivalent, they like it as it should be. And so that was another great advantage. And of course, Carl Ebert, the great director from Glyndebourne, came to direct two of our operas, and I sort of took his eye, and he took me to Glyndebourne, and that's how I got there. And then I sang at Glyndebourne, started with Mazzetto and Don Giovanni at the Edinburgh Festival in 1948, and went on singing on and off for them right up to 1962, and made recordings of Barbieri di Siviglia, Cenerentola, Cinderella keeps coming into the story in a rather delightful way. And then, of course, at Glyndebourne, Vittorio Gui was the great brought Rossini to them, and then he took me to Italy to sing Cenerentola in Rome and Barbieri di Siviglia in Venezia. So all that took up the first half of my career, in a sense. But always in the winter, Glyndebourne, of course, being a summer festival, I didn't have an opera job to go to, like Sadler's Wells or The Garden in the winter. And I was not, in those days, at all established as a concert singer. except to appear a guest appearance and sing a couple of operatic arias and that sort of thing. But I did pantomime and a lot of television and some films, a lot of radio. So it's always been a great mixture of things. That's how I met people like Noel Coward, as we were talking about earlier on. I sort of touched it all at a good many points.
Well, I did want to ask you about that other change in your career when you met Donald Swann.
That was a great event, as I think I said when we were talking before we started the interview, that the song that changed my life, which sounds, you know, terribly over the top. But it was true in a way, because I had found myself rather surprisingly in the opera world. I had no idea that my voice was up to operatic requirements, as you might say. I had always sung right from starting as a soprano, boy soprano in the choir at school, but never thinking that it was going to be used in that sort of way, and I hadn't had the training and all this, just a few singing lessons. And to find that I was suddenly in the opera, imprisoned in a sense, because there were a lot of things that I felt on the more popular side that I would be frowned on if I did them. And then along comes Donald and Michael with a song about an amorous hippopotamus that pleased the Glyndebourne audience as much, except the occasional dowager who in the bar afterwards would say, "What a waste, that song you sing about a hippopotamus. Do you have to do it?" I said, "Yes, I do, for various reasons." But apart from that, the musical content of the Flanders and Swann songs, not just the hippopotamus, but the elephant, which they wrote specially for me, and various other ones like the gondolier, which was, you know, required a bit of singing. I don't know whether you know the gondolier. It's about an Italian gondolier on the Manchester Ship Canal, and all the possibilities of that well exploited. And there was a sort of bridge, an ecumenical bridge to the lighter theatre. And I found then, from then on, I could cross, and I think I was one of those who, in a sense, led this movement towards opera singers being accepted, doing other things as well as simply singing in opera, which it had been. The musical snobbery had been very considerable when I first started out, and so I've been able to do all sorts of things. And I'm sort of pausing because I'm remembering a famous artist who used to live in Highgate, Norman Wilkinson, who was a famous war artist in two world wars. And he stopped me once in the road. He said, "I heard you on the radio in one of those variety shows prostituting your art." But with a smile on his face, I said, "I'm a very happy prostitute." I always took the view, if you did something as well as you could, it didn't much matter what it was, as long as it was pleasing an audience that was worth pleasing. That sounds terribly pompous and down your hooter, you know, but it's true nevertheless.
I next asked him about Leslie Hutch Hutchinson.
I first remember him as a wonderful cabaret artist, I suppose just after the war, or maybe even earlier, singing songs like "Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries" and "A Cigarette That Bears a Lipstick's Traces," "An Airline Ticket to a Romantic Place." Yes. Wonderful nasal style he had. And I always enjoyed hearing him on the radio. And then one time we did a broadcast together, and we had a chance to talk. And I said, you've had a marvellous long career in much the same field all the time. Yes, he said, "Aren't I lucky? Because first of all, it was the the grandmothers of the ones who come and listen to me today. Then it was their daughters. Now it's their granddaughters, and they all seem to like the music. I'm so lucky. He said, do you know, I get asked to go and sing at cabaret in the stately homes of England. He said, you wouldn't believe this. He said, one or two of those stately homes, they seem so grand. And yet when you go to the toilet, where you would expect it to be all very well appointed, you find that somebody has cut up a whole lot of squares of the Evening Standard and put them on a spike, and that's the toilet paper. I couldn't believe it. I'm not sure whether he was having me on, but he was so happy to think that he could please the grandchildren with the same sort of style. And I think that's because he was an artist of great sincerity and sang with his heart as well as his voice.
Did you ever appear in any musicals?
Well, I appeared in this musical, Fanny, which was a musical version of the Marcel Pagnol trilogy, film trilogy, at Drury Lane, playing opposite Robert Morley. And I played the part that was played in New York by Ezio Pinza. So that was... The musical didn't do very well over here. We ran 10 months, which for Drury Lane is not very long. That experience was one which opened a lot of other doors in television, and I found myself doing musicals on television, and a marvellous pantomime at the London Coliseum, which is now the home of English National Opera. It was Aladdin, with lyrics by Cole Porter and music by Cole Porter, and choreographed by Robert Helpman, decor by Loudon St. Hill, you know, marvellous, and a cast, people like Doretta Morrow, and just so many wonderful experiences that have come through being able to say, yes, I'll do it, rather than, oh, no, I don't think I ought to do that. People might, you know. No.
What do you think of the quality of popular music today?
Well, I can't sort of relate to it very well. I can relate to some. I mean, I can relate to the Beatles, and I can relate to most of them when they get much older, and I suppose it's they have mellowed and come nearer the centre. But I find a lot of it is very repetitive, and depends on strobing lights and various other inducements as well as the music itself. No, it's my son, on the other hand, who is up, you may have heard the strains of a sax playing when you first came in. Dear boy, he lives down in Dorset, and with his partner and our only grandson, who's going to be 6 in January and is an absolute winner. And he plays the saxophone. He's in sort of rhythm and blues, jazz, and used to headed a rock band. He's never made a lot of money, but he's very well respected in the profession. And I like his music, I must say. Not just because I'm his father.
Well, I appreciate you spending all of this time with us and giving us some of the background, your background and also that of my music.
Perhaps I mention before I stop that one of my great interests, particularly since the medics... told me that I mustn't chase all over the country all the time doing my show. Other things happened. Apart from that, I found myself in a Scottish soap opera called Take the High Road for about 4 years, which I think some of the episodes are shown in, certainly in Canada, and maybe in America. But I also became president of a charity called Music in Hospitals, and we do now something over 4,000 live professional concerts in long-stay hospitals, hospices, homes for the elderly, children's hospitals, whatever, you name it, throughout the United Kingdom. And it's been wonderful to see this thing grow and help it in what ways I can over a period of 13 years. I just retired a year ago, and they made me president emeritus so that I haven't lost touch with them. And that's been, I feel, sort of something that's probably more worth doing than anything else I've done.
Well, a great note to end on. And thank you very much for spending this time with us.
It's been a great pleasure, Alan.
Thank you.